There's a lot going on out there now, isn't there? A lot of things really caught my attention in the news this last week, and I thought related to what I wanted to talk about. I noticed online on our site, I'm not sure how I stumbled there, what I was looking for, but Mr. Melvin Rose presented a message in November 2006, and it was titled Seven Unfulfilled Prophecies. And he later converted that into an article that's now available as part of our literature, which is the one I came across. And the title of that article was changed a little to Seven Prophecies That Must Be Fulfilled Before Jesus Christ's Return. And as we see so much going on in the world around us, I thought it might be worthwhile to review these prophecies presented by Mr. Rhodes. And therefore, I took some time and added some pictures and text. And I'd ask, just what are these prophecies that he reviewed? What are these prophecies that must be fulfilled before and actually shortly before the return of Christ? People throughout apparently all generations, it seems, since the death of Christ, have thought he might come back during their time, could or would return during their generation. This included even the Apostle Paul. But shortly before his crucifixion, Christ told his apostles that certain things must happen before he could return. And some of these things could not have happened in Paul's time. This major prophecy by Christ is recorded in Matthew 24, in Mark 13, and in Luke 21, and it's called the Olivet Prophecy. It's called that because he was on the Mount of Olives when he gave that. So let's turn to Matthew 24 and see just how this prophecy begins. Matthew 24 is a familiar chapter. And here we have Christ, Matthew 24 and verse 1, going out and departing from the temple, and we were just talking about the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. So they're saying, look how amazing this is. Look how marvelous this temple is. This is really something. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." We know this happened in 70 AD, the destruction of the temple. And continuing here, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying," because now he's got their attention, when's this going to happen? What you just said, that was interesting. "Tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you." Something we need to always keep in our mind. "For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ." Saying, "I am the Christ." They're going to say that Jesus is the Christ, but then they're not going to teach his message and will deceive many. This first sign by Christ is one that began in the church he established almost immediately after he ascended to heaven, and one Christ elsewhere warned about, one we must continually watch for. Hold your place in Matthew 24, but look a few pages over to Matthew 7, where we see Christ giving this warning. Matthew 7, in verse 15 to 17, he says, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, so they look innocent, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit." So this is how we measure things. We watch. We see what kind of fruit they bear. To measure a person, we can do that. And we were just talking, Dr. Austin, announcements about Mr. Kubik and the letter he wrote, and Mr. Holliday shared that this last week, and the letter of good news recipients, and I thought, wow, that's a good letter, strong letter, and I feel like UCG leadership is producing much good fruit now, something we want to see, something we need to see, the way things are being conducted at church. So Christ said, "Beware of false ministers," and not long after, about 20 years after, Paul said about false ministers, we don't need to turn there, but Galatians 1:6, I marvel that you are so soon turning to another gospel. So this is something we must keep our eyes on, something to be aware. And as we continue in Matthew 24, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. So war has again, like false prophets, like false ministers, been a fact of human history. Over the past 5,600 years, wars have been occurring at a level to be recorded in history for over 5,300 of those years. We seem to be prone toward war, don't we, as a people? Over 92% of our recorded history, we're fighting at a level that it went into the books and was written down for us. These two first signs, false ministers, false teachers, and war, have been occurring throughout time since Christ's crucifixion. And we can expect these things to escalate as we move closer to the end. That's something we should be prepared for, something to watch. But I'd like to ask, does the Bible reveal other things that have not been seen throughout recorded history? Until very recently, until the present generation even. What are they? When were they fulfilled? Are they yet all fulfilled? Or do we still need to watch for some of these things? So my title today, and it's up on the board, Seven End Time Prophecies. And we could put parenthetically if we want, that could be fulfilled only in the last generation. Seven End Time Prophecies. Note verse 22 of Matthew 24, where we are here in this Olivet prophecy. This is something that Paul could not have really understood. Paul could not have understood. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. So we're talking about the time of trials that we're coming into, and it's going to be at a level that God would have to shorten those days, but for the elect's sake, for the first fruit's sake, those days will be shortened. English Standard Version of the Bible says of this, or records the verse this way, if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be cut short. New Living Translation of the Bible says, unless that time of calamity is shortened, not a single person would survive. But it will be shortened for the sake of God's chosen ones. So while war has been a near continual part of humanity's existence, there is coming a time when war is going to get away from us. Perhaps we might call it World War III, the war that we attempt to wage, really would be the war to end all wars. And at this stage, as we prepare to unleash it, humans do have the ominous prophesied power that Paul couldn't imagine to totally remove human life from this planet. Jordan, can you show that next slide, please? I think I have a picture of the Earth there, and it's kind of hard to imagine, as large as this planet is, that a battle anywhere could kill someone way down here, and someone way over here, and someone here, and that we can wage a war such that nobody could survive. How did that happen? When did we first gain that power? When did Christ's Matthew 24:22 prophecy start becoming a reality? Why is this an important question for us? Look in verse 34 of this chapter, in Matthew 24, about these signs that Christ is revealing here. When his apostles said, tell us, when will it be? When will these things happen? When will you return? Assuredly, I say to you, this generation, the one that sees all these signs, will by no means pass away until all these things take place. The generation that sees the prophetic signs listed in and biblically related to the Olivet prophecy will survive until the return of Christ. By 1930, people had come to understand that radioactive atoms spontaneously decay. It's like uranium going to lead. Takes a while, it has a half-life. Some of those atoms do this, and when they do it, they release a high-energy particle. And the next slide depicts that, shows that happening. So energy comes out, and then there's a high-speed particle here. This is a neutron that will come out there. And we realize that if this particle strikes another one of these atoms, it will cause that atom to do the same thing. But for the most part, these atoms are too far apart inside a brick, a rock of uranium, so that chain reaction doesn't occur. So the next slide shows that. Here, that should this one strike that one, it'll do the same thing. And each time, a lot of energy is released. And in the 30s, people started realizing, if we could enrich uranium, you know, the way people think, if we could, then maybe we could get this so that it will continue. And the next slide kind of shows that picture, something like this, where we get a chain reaction going, and people found or they realized that even enriching uranium is not enough. We need to do something more than that. And so the next slide shows what people did. And this is an atomic bomb, and here's a uranium core in the middle, and it was realized if we can squeeze it together, then these atoms are close enough together that when one spontaneously decays, it's pretty likely that high-speed particle is going to hit another, and the one from that's going to hit another and another, and we'll have a chain reaction, and a tremendous amount of energy is going to be released. So all that was done is conventional explosives were placed all around the uranium core, set off at the same time, and they push the uranium together. And then it's dense enough that the chain reaction will occur, and it goes very quickly when that happens. So that's how an atomic bomb works. I have commented before, I took a physics class in college, and I didn't know this, but the guy who taught it was one of the ones who made this first bomb, Dr. Spiegelmeyer. Now, that's someone in Atlanta. I told the wrong name. I've forgotten his name, I remember his face, but anyway, it was the most fascinating story when he told us about making this bomb. And he said, you know, it's not something you want to do, but we really felt that if we don't get this before the Germans, we're all going to be German. So I did help make this bomb. So on August 6th and August 9th, 1945, the United States detonated atomic bombs like this one over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, to end that war. Next slide shows Hiroshima. And the terrible destruction there where this bomb went off, I believe it was 140,000 people died instantly when we dropped that thing. That was destruction from an 18-kiloton bomb, 18,000 tons of TNT. You've probably been reading in the news lately, and it just makes my knees go weak about North Carolina and this revealing that we had a B-52 come apart in the air going over North Carolina in 1961, and it had two 3.8 megaton nuclear bombs on it. And they said it was just the slightest of chance that two wires didn't cross on those things as it went down. They didn't blow up. And the title of the article is along the lines of "The Night We Almost Lost North Carolina." And so what's on the screen behind me is the damage caused by an 18-kiloton bomb. Two 3.8 megaton bombs, and we've got them much bigger now, but I calculated that's 4,222 times bigger than the bomb that did that. We're lucky, and I think God held it back, because it's not time for something like that to happen in the States yet. But boy, doesn't that just put a chill up your back that we could have done that to ourselves? How they were flying a plane that broke apart in air, I don't know, with something like that on board. What we might do as we go ahead, I don't know the mistakes we could make. But so this is 1945 on the slide. In 1949, the Soviet Union conducted its first atomic test. In 1952, the U.S. conducted the first test of a fusion or nuclear bomb. In 1954, the United States detonated the first deliverable thermonuclear weapon at Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands. That one had twice the yield that we expected, and it led to the worst radiological disaster in the United States history, thermonuclear weapon. I remember back in college, I took a biochemistry course, and it wasn't Dr. Spiegelmeyer's, Dr. Longmuir that taught that course. He was a Cambridge-trained biochemist, and I don't know why he got on the topic, but one day he started talking about nuclear war. And his comment was, you know, it just doesn't matter if we shoot them at each other or if we just shoot them up in the air and let them blow up in the sky. He said humanity will not survive either way. Dr. Longmuir, that would have been about 1980. I was in that class. So Matthew 24:22 is a prophecy that wasn't fulfillable. We didn't have this power until about 50 years ago when the United States and Soviet Union had built an arsenal of nuclear weapons capable of actually killing every human being living on this planet. Something that really just wouldn't compute to Paul. I wonder if he thought we would just be fighting at a level around the world so that everybody would be killed, but that's not going to work well either. The nuclear might of the two superpowers, Soviet Union and us, has since been added to by Great Britain, France, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and others, and we know North Korea is working to develop a deliverable nuclear weapon. Kim Jong-un, next slide, is the leader of that country, and I have to ask the question, what might a man like this do with a nuclear weapon? You know, I think the United States, for good reasons, doesn't want him to have one. The Matthew 24:22 prophecy of Christ has only been fulfilled in the present generation. We have gained an amazing power to make this planet unsuitable to support human life, and we have the ability to kill all humans. Kind of scary that we would actually go that far with Satan as ruler of this planet if God wouldn't stop it. End time prophecy 1 has been accomplished. The next end time prophecy is related to this first one. To introduce, turn to Zechariah, which is just two books back in the Old Testament here before Matthew. Zechariah 12 and verse 1. Zechariah 12, verse 1, before Malachi here, and we find the burden, and this means the oracle, the word of the Lord. The burden of the word of the Lord is against Israel. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundations of the earth, and forms the spirit within him. So this is God who says that. That's an interesting little verse right there, too. Forms the spirit of man within him. This is what makes us different from the animals. But anyway, behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. So pay attention to those words. Jerusalem and the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall happen that in that day I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces. Though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. So we're talking about a time. Is this the final battle that Christ must stop to preserve human life? Is this the point that prophecy 1 would manifest? Notice verse 4. In that day, says the Lord. And we know this is often used to talk about the day of the Lord, after the tribulation, the end time. I will strike every horse with confusion and its rider with madness. I will open my eyes on the house of Judah and will strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. So the military he's going to strike. And in verse 6, in that day I will make governors of Judah like a fire pan in the wood pile, like a fiery torch in the sheaves. So we're talking about Judah again. In verse 9, in that day, it shall be in that day that I will destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. So here we have a continuing theme through here of nations coming against Judah, against David, against Jerusalem. And in verse 10, are we in the end time? And I will pour out on the house of David and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. And then they will look on me whom they pierced. Yes, they will mourn for him as one mourns for his only son and grieve for him as one grieves for a firstborn. So God's spirit will be poured out on the people and they will see Christ. Obviously, this hasn't happened yet. What else shows us that these verses speak of a future time? Look in verse 8 of this chapter. In that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, his people. The one who is feeble among them in that day shall be like David, strong as David was, strong fighter. And the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. And if we look just across the page in chapter 14, verse 1, behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil shall be divided in your midst, for I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished, half the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Verse 3, then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of the battle. And in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, and this is how they will see him. How they will see him. Could this have happened? What we're reading about here, about this siege against Judah, Jerusalem, could this have happened in 1850? Was that possible then? People laying siege against Jerusalem and Judah. Could this have happened in 1930? Was it possible then? Look in Luke 21. This sign, and we're back in the Olivet prophecy. Luke 21 and verse 20 to 22. And we're going to read about the same thing we just read about in Zechariah. Luke 21, 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know its destruction is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. Let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written might be fulfilled. What must have happened before Zechariah 12 and Luke 21 can occur? And the answer to that is end time prophecy number 2. Before armies could encompass Judah and the house of David in Jerusalem, a Jewish homeland had to be reestablished in the Middle East, because they weren't there. So these things required a Jewish homeland to be reestablished. It's a mandatory requirement of the fulfillment of these prophecies that Judah, a nation of Jews, would come back into existence. And so now reading from history.state.gov, just went on the internet and pulled up, and there's a lot of these. Throughout 1947, the United Nations Special Commission on Palestine examined the Palestinian question and recommended the partition of Palestine into a Jewish and an Arab state. So this is prophetically very important that this occurred. On November 29, 1947, the United Nations adopted Resolution 181 that would divide Great Britain's former Palestine mandate into Jewish and Arab states in May 1948. On May 14, 1948, David Ben-Gurion, head of the Jewish Agency, proclaimed the establishment of the State of Israel. And the next slide shows a newspaper from that time, and you probably can't read it. State of Israel is born. Jews take over security zone. U.S. recognizes the Jewish state. So this occurred May 14, 1948. United States President Harry S. Truman recognized the new nation that same day, and the next slide shows President Truman with a man named Elihu Elith, who was an Israeli diplomat who worked in the foreign relations section of the Jewish Agency, which eventually evolved into the Government of Israel. And from 1948 to 1950, this man served as the first Israeli ambassador to the United States. So it's a prophetic necessity that Judah had to exist as a sovereign nation before Christ could return. There had been no Jewish nation in the Middle East for over 1,800 years before this 1948 reestablishment. The prophecy of armies surrounding Jerusalem in a Jewish nation made no sense to my grandparents in the 1920s or the 1930s because the Jews weren't there. 1940s. Nothing since World War II has made the world a more dangerous place than the reestablishment of Israel, of Judah. And as we know, these tensions continue to grow in the Arab world. Much of the Arabs desire to push Israel into the sea. It's a direct quote from who I forget, but I recall reading. So Mr. Rose, in his article, mentioned a major concern he had about the ability of Israel to survive much longer in the Middle East. And it is very tenuous over there. This was that their security depends on the United States. And he asked, if this country suffers some big step back whereby we cannot protect them, which I think we may all see looming, what happens to the security of the lone Jewish nation in the Middle East? You know, as an insert, I often think about this. It seems unavoidable to me that end time prophecies would simply fly forward if the United States disappeared somehow. As terrible as that is to think about, if this country falls, it seems so many prophecies could just fly forward. But anyway, the reestablishment of a Jewish homeland in the Middle East occurred 66 years ago. The number of people remaining in the generation born since 1948 is rapidly diminishing. As these people are all 66 or more years old. Look at Psalm 90. I thought this was kind of interesting. Just how does God define generations? Psalm 90 and verse 10 in that psalm. Because the Jewish homeland was reestablished in 1948, Psalm 90, verse 10. And here God says, the days of your life are 70 years, and if you're strong, they're 80. That's what it says in the next few words. By reason of strength, they're 80 years. So end time prophecy number two has been fulfilled. We do have the Jewish nation reestablished. In fact, this one's growing old. The generation that saw Israel reform is reaching its end. If God's definition of a generation is 70 years, we've got four more years. If it's 80, we've got 14 years for that generation to still be there. End time prophecy number three. Before Christ can return, a king of the north and a king of the south will have to exist, as described in Daniel 11. So let's turn to Daniel 11. I've mentioned a number of times, as opposed to mainstream churches that say, you better be ready, Christ could return tonight. Well, Christ isn't going to return tonight as much as we would like for that to happen. The usual reason I give is we're just not prophetically ready right now. Have we seen the two witnesses? No. Are the king of the north and the king of the south in position right now? Similar to what would happen to Israel's security if the United States were to fall, I often wonder what would bring the end time king of the north and the king of the south into place more quickly than a cataclysmic fall of the United States. But you're probably in Daniel. I'm not quite there yet. Daniel 11 in verse 40. Daniel 11:40. At the time of the end. So you see the time we're in here in this verse. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. And we know, and I'm assuming this knowledge, basically which peoples we're talking about here, with chariots, horsemen, and many other ships, with all the military might they can muster, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through them. Daniel 11 was written in the 6th century B.C., and we know had a series of fulfillments in the 4th, in the 3rd, in the 2nd century B.C., including things like Alexander the Great and Antiochus Epiphanes and others, over a 400-year period, and we know that Alexander died young and split his kingdom, his empire, among four generals, two of which became particularly prominent, Seleucus, who founded the Seleucid dynasty to the north of Judah, and Ptolemy, the southern dynasty, continuing for 11 generations to the south. And I believe the next slide shows these. We might have lost one, but see if you back up one if they're where that blank slide. Okay, so for some reason we turned to blank, but that's okay, leave it there. So you're generally familiar with the area of Israel and the north, the Seleucid dynasty above that, and the Ptolemaic dynasty below that was what was supposed to be on that slide, and we've got some glitch that's not showing that, but not a critical slide there. So we should notice then, as Daniel 11 proceeds through these prophecies, that in verse 40 we jump to the end, to the time of the end, and a major clash between the king of the north and the king of the south. And we might ask, why does prophecy in Daniel 11 stop and then suddenly pick up at the time of the end? And it all comes back to a missing necessity. A Jewish nation located south of the king of the north and north of the king of the south, centrally located in the promised land, first given them by God between clashing world powers. Okay, and I think that slide's probably missing two. I don't know. Go ahead, two slides maybe, Jordan. Let me see what's there. Okay, that's cool. There's the promised land. So the next slide after that, I mean, the centrally located. And the Seleucid dynasty would be in this area, and the Ptolemaic would be in this area, surrounding both sides of those. So these lands, let's see, okay, here we go, promised. So historically, the Jews before 1948 had been a people without a homeland. And when they were petitioning for one at this time, the British initially offered them, I didn't know this, but offered them Uganda in Africa, and Stalin desired to place them somewhere in Siberia. And let's see what the next slide shows. See if we're gone. Okay, that's good. I must have goofed these up somehow and didn't know it. But here's Uganda as a site that the British were entertaining putting the Jewish people. And Siberia is up here in the northern Russian area where there's not much worth having. And these lands were offered but couldn't prophetically work. Is this third prophecy, prophetic necessity of Daniel 11:40 now in place before Christ can return? Is there a king of the north and a king of the south positioned north and south of Jerusalem to wage the final war? Now, the answer to this question is no, it's really not right now. We can clearly see the foundation for the prophetic role players to quickly fall into place. And it made me think just the last couple of days of what's going on in the region of the King of the South with Iraq and Syria and these terrorists moving through that country and taking one city and then another with the desire to produce a strict Islamic state. And I wonder about what's happening in the Kingdom of the South. CNN yesterday said the threat of Sunni extremists eclipsing the power of the Shiite-dominated Arab ally presents Iran with the biggest security and strategic challenge it has faced since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. So this is quite a shakeup that's going on over there in Iraq, and President Obama has said, you're on your own, we're not getting into this. With the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, again quoting from CNN, an offshoot of al-Qaeda, rapidly gaining territory, Iran deployed Revolutionary Guard units to Iraq. According to Iranian security forces, the King of the South Empire, this is me now, could develop very rapidly with the right pushes. So let's see what the next slide is, and I think we're going well now. I just pulled this off CNN last night, and it shows this area, and here's Syria and Iraq. Iran's right over here, and of course Israel is right down in here. So it is a tenuous area surrounding the Jewish country over there. End time prophecy number four. Let's go to Revelation 11. Things that could only happen in our generation that are falling into place. Revelation, did I say 11? Revelation 17. Revelation 17 and verse 12. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not received or who have received no kingdom as of yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour, for a short time, as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they give power. They will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with Christ when he returns with Christ, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. So we're again aware of these prophecies in Revelation 17, Revelation 13, Daniel 2, and Daniel 7, and the theme of Nebuchadnezzar's vision of successive empires running through 2,600 years of history, and beginning with the Babylonian Empire, continuing with Medo-Persian and the Greeks, and then the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire fell 1,500 years ago, history has shown a series of resurrections in this Europe-centered empire. And let's see what the next slide might be, and if bring that slide back. Okay, and that's good. So here's the historic resurrections of the Roman Empire. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, we believe, is now forming this last prophetic resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. So in verse 12, we saw here the ten horns you saw are ten kings that we should expect from this area. As part of the end time King of the North, ten last kings, our rulers, are going to show up and will give power and authority to a beast, or a governmental system that they're going to establish. And we saw that in verse 13. And so these are the figures I've placed down here, these ten rulers that we can expect. This is an odd situation, really, in Europe, where nations have elected to give up their sovereignty like this and pull together to gain the additional strength and security of their united power. This will, as we move forward, include a rapid final uniting and a returning to historic religious roots in this group. What could push these 10 European heads of state to do this? Why would they do this? Why the return to religious roots that we know will be part of this? I wonder if it will be a necessity from a very strong future Muslim challenge, or from a Muslim-led initiative similar to 9/11 but stronger and more effective that has brought down the U.S. and put the world into turmoil. Something's going to stimulate these individuals to come together in a very powerful way and give their authority to what would appear to be an Assyrian central control unit in there. We don't know yet, but we can again see these things going back to the Berlin Wall, this down, that the EU exists. The European Union could very quickly elect to form a power block of some sort for their very survival. And I expect that's what's going to drive this final coming together for an hour, for a short time. We have only in history very recently been positioned for Prophecy 5 and for these 10 kings to come on the scene. 10 kings who will pull together for 1 hour, probably pushed by a huge crisis. I suspect these people are alive over in Europe now and well positioned to step into their final roles, given where we are in prophecy. Just my musings, I suppose. Enzyme prophecy number 5. Turn to Hosea, which is the book after Daniel. Daniel and Hosea, and Hosea chapter 5. Another end time prophecy. Hosea 5 and verse 5. In the minor prophets, we find so much about end time Israel, and it's so descriptive of how we become as a people and a country. Hosea 5:5, the pride of Israel testifies to his face. Therefore Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbles with them. They stumble together, Israel, Ephraim, Judah. And verse 7, it's one of those scary ones. They have dealt treacherously with the Lord. Could anyone deny that that's kind of the way we are now? For they have begotten pagan children. Now a new moon shall devour them and their heritage. When this happens, it's going to be quick. It's going to happen very quickly, and only God will be able to protect us. A new moon will devour them. This is a 30-day period that's being described here that will devour Israel, Ephraim, and Judah. Has this ever been seen in history? Is this a future event, or have we ever seen something like this? We can't further review the details right now, but we know generally the tribes of Judah, Benjamin, and part of Levi became the house of Judah historically, and the Jewish people today, and were settled in the country called Israel. And I think I put a slide for that of these tribes, and here they are. And there's Jacob, whose name became Israel, and his 12 sons are the 12 tribes of Israel. And here Benjamin and Judah and part of Levi became the house of Judah. They settled in the southern part there of this slide. And the 10 tribes moved north with capital in Samaria and took on the prophetic name Israel, the other 10 tribes. And they were later carried into captivity, and again by Assyria in the 8th century B.C., and Judah fell 100 years later to the Babylonians. So there was no 30-day period involved in that fall. We're talking about another event here in Hosea. And within early Israel, within these tribes, were two tribes that came to particularly carry the name of Israel, and those are Ephraim and Manasseh. As a result of Jacob's blessing, let my name be placed on those boys. So again, I'm assuming this knowledge, and I know it's with us. And the next slide shows that where Joseph's children, Ephraim and Manasseh, have been brought here to Jacob or Israel, who places his name on these boys. Okay, so you're aware of that. And in light of this prophecy in Hosea, consider Ephraim. the tribe that was to become the multitude of nations. And today there's just not a lot left of that collection of nations, is there, of the old British Empire. Beyond the British, the Canadians, the Australians, and New Zealand, this is from a commonwealth that once included over 60 countries and tremendous wealth. And the next slide should show the British Commonwealth at its peak. And okay, that maybe went backwards. There we go. And there in red there, the countries that were part of the British Commonwealth and tremendous wealth there. And then Hosea 5, 1, where we are here. Hear this, O priests. Take heed, O house of Israel. Okay, so we know who the house of Israel is. Give ear, O house of the king, for yours is the judgment. Because you have been a snare to Mizpah and a net spread over Tabor, the revolters are deeply involved in slaughter, though I rebuke them all. I know Ephraim, says God. I know who they are. I know where they are. I know my people. And Israel is not hidden from me. So God knows his people. And now, Ephraim, you commit harlotry, going after false gods. And Israel is defiled. So Israel and the brothers are being addressed. I know Ephraim, the one who would be the greatest at his peak, says God. And Israel, or Jacob, God says, I know him. With his brother Manasseh, the U.S., they are not hidden from me. They are defiled. They do not know me. The U.S. and the British, Ephraim and Manasseh together, have over the last half century shown divided support for Israel. Our unrecognized brother Judah, we really don't know who they are, but in 1950 Suez Canal crisis, the British supported Israel and the U.S. didn't. In the following years, the British fell away from their support of Israel while the U.S. became staunch supporters. The recent war against terrorism that really started in earnest in 9/11 has pulled these tribes much more together. We are today well positioned for Hosea 5:7. This is a prophecy that could not have been fulfilled until very recently. Having these brothers all in existence as countries, generally united as we are and ready to fall together in a 30-day period, we are positioned for Prophecy 5, a terrible fall of Israel. I know it's something you hate to talk about. It's not going to be pretty. I've heard people talk about how they're going to survive it and have their own food and grow it, and people are going to come and get it. Really, only God will get us through what's going to happen when we reach Hosea 5:7. And what I always advise myself is, well, we must pray for God's protection in the place of safety as we move toward this day. End time prophecy 6, back in Matthew 24, maybe the most familiar to God's church. Matthew 24, in verse 14. And the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. And again, I think about the Apostle Paul, and Dr. Ross has recently been reviewing the journeys of Paul, whom he may have felt that he was satisfying this prophecy with his helpers. Next slide shows these journeys of Paul. And you can see all the region that he reached. So Paul may have felt, yeah, we're doing this. We're satisfying the prophecy. But Paul's journeys didn't carry the kingdom of God to China, the far reaches of Asia, to Africa, to other lands that Paul didn't even know existed. How far has God's church been able to carry the gospel message in recent years? You know, we've even passed anything that Mr. Armstrong could imagine, and his death not being that long ago in the big picture. He totally unaware of the internet and what we could do and how we could reach with that. He didn't grasp. We used to marvel at all the countries and all the rulers of nations that Mr. Armstrong was invited to come and sit down with, and he'd fly there and that. The church's Gulf Stream jet, for those of you who are old enough to remember that. And not that his visits weren't important, but in a very minimal way was he carrying the gospel message to different countries when he did that. compared to what we can do now? How has that changed in recent years? Where in this world does the computer not reach? I think about a man who contacted me several years ago from West Gambia, Africa. He's a physician, wanted to talk about people who were dying among the tribes he treated from immune suppression he felt they shouldn't have. But I could sit and talk to this guy face to face through our computers using Skype, a program some of you are probably aware of, and I would talk with Dr. Ogo Chukwu Ofordili. And we could see each other and we could talk in real time. I remember talking with a radiologist in Australia who wanted to come work for us, same way, by Skype, and I could look at her and we spoke. Where do our computers not reach? Where does Beyond Today not go? Beyond Today, our literature, all of our electronic resources are now available globe-wide in all countries. The gospel message truly is in all the world as a witness. The message, this message, I expect, will see its final end time expansion. Where is this gospel really going to reach everybody? Final end time expansion in the ministry of the two witnesses. And that will complete that. And if not fully accomplished now, these individuals surely will accomplish that then. So look at our country. I mean, really look at us. Where are we financially and especially morally? What's our condition? I have to believe that only God's holding us up right now. And only because we are the economic engine behind Matthew 24:14, that this gospel will go to the entire world as a witness. Once this verse is fulfilled to God's satisfaction, I don't see why we'll be blessed or supported or held up any longer. And doesn't it again start sounding like all these end-time prophecies we're reviewing today are hinging around the same thing? The United States staying in its position, a coming very quick fall of Israel. U.S., Great Britain, Judah, in the space of one new moon, could bring so much about. I don't know, but it just kind of looks that way. I commented in another recent message, I feel like we're coming to a time. And the church has said this all my life, but it just feels this way more now, that we need to be sure to hold tight to our chairs in God's church and not let anything pull us out. Final prophecy, prophecy 7, Revelation 11. Revelation 11 and verse 3. And I've mentioned these two individuals. Revelation 11, verse 3. And I will give my power to my two witnesses. They will have power, very strong power of the Holy Spirit. And they will prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. And in verse 6, they will have the power to shut heaven, the sky, so that no rain falls in the days of their prophecy. And they have power over waters to turn them into blood and to strike the earth with all plagues, sounds so much like Moses and Israel, as often as they desire. When they finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them. And this is 3 days before the return of Christ, and their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. Then those from the peoples, tribes, tongues and nations will see their dead bodies 3.5 days and will not allow their bodies to be put into graves. So this is with the death of the three witnesses. How did my grandmother interpret this verse when she sat during the Great Depression and read her Bible, that all the nations, all the peoples would be able to see these two individuals dead in the street? At that, what really is a recent time in history, these verses didn't make sense. We didn't have the ability. How could someone in Portsmouth, Ohio, which is where she was, USA, see two dead bodies that were on the streets half a world away? And the answer is, of course, they couldn't. This prophecy only began making sense with the space age, with our ability to put satellites above the earth. And I think I've got a picture of one of those, Jordan. That's a pretty picture, isn't it? I guess maybe the space shuttle was up above that satellite looking down on it. Boy, there's a lot of technology right there. Well, we could put these into orbit, in fixed orbit, so they stay in the same place, so your satellite receiver can aim at the same spot. And really, they're going around the Earth at exactly the same speed the Earth is turning, so they stay above the same spot of the land the whole time, and that's remarkable technology. So with this type of technology, we can now instantly transmit images around the world. So if something's going on in Rome, Italy, we can see it. We can watch it as it happens. Or in Iraq, as we have been seeing. Or in Brazil, or wherever, we can indeed watch. And with the two witnesses, they're going to be so hated for the message they're bringing out, this message of the M, that once dead, the world, and that'll be the remaining world at that time, the U.S. will be gone by then, will say, let them decompose on the street. And by images transferred to our TVs, our phones, our computers, our tablets, the nations will see them lying there, all nations, all peoples. So this prophecy that Paul couldn't have understood, that my grandma couldn't understand, makes all the sense in the world to you and me, doesn't it? It's not a problem. We can see how this works now. Has prophecy 7 been fulfilled yet? No. No, the two witnesses aren't on the scene yet. Some in God's church have left and proclaimed themselves to be the two witnesses. I remember a minister joking once that he knew 4 of the two witnesses. I imagine these people, these two witnesses, may very well be alive today, like the 10 kings. I think we can take confidence that whoever they are, God will position them, and they will never proclaim themselves to be filling that role, and they're not going to need to. So in summary for these prophecies, and we ended with the two coming witnesses, we've seen 7 prophecies that could only make sense to humans who are alive today and could only be fulfilled in this last generation. Realizing this, how should we proceed? Let's go to Matthew 24, back where we started, to finish. Matthew 24. In verse 21. Again, Matthew 24, 21. For then there shall be great tribulation. And no one with a healthy mind wants to see this, but nonetheless we need to be prepared, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor shall ever be. And unless those days were shortened, no humans would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. And then in verse 45 of this chapter, verse 45 to 47, who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his master made ruler over his household, to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. So this, of course, is where we want to be. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over his goods. How shall we proceed? As in those verses. Christ is coming back for his elect, his first fruits, his church. We need to keep our eyes on this. Christ is coming for us. And when this happens and we're all meeting him in the clouds in the sky, we're not going to be alone. We're going to find each other. I think we'll look and not try and be silly. Say, oh, there's Matthew. There's Sam. There's Laura. We're not going to be alone. We're going to be a family. And we'll be together when this happens. We'll find each other. Together we'll begin the next step toward the exciting job God has placed before us that continues forever into eternity.